National media continues to promote negative headlines intentionally designed to diminish the rule of law and those whose job it is to enforce it. We want you to hear from the source rather than a misleading soundbite. To keep this conversation going, support us on the lawmatters1030.org website. It's time we listen to and said thank you to those who spend their lives protecting us. Now let's start the show. Good morning, everybody. I hope you have your world map out. We have Hal Kumpfer on the phone, and he's going to take us for a trip around the world, security-wise. Good morning, Hal.
Morning, Sherry. There's a lot going on in the world.
I know.
Where should we start?
Let's start right here in America. I'm curious, and I had a few people ask this, and this is why I'm going to ask you. What Trump did with these documents, how dangerous is that for our security, or do we even know?
Well, that's what they're assessing. You know, anytime there's a breach of unauthorized release of classified material, there has to be a whole counterintelligence investigation that takes place. Looking at the information that was there, looking at sources and methods, what could be gleaned from that in terms of assessments, conclusions, indications that a foreign intelligence service, a foreign government could possibly use to figure out where or how we're gathering information. Now, in the classic sense, there could be an information that something in there. And it could be just a little nugget of information, like one sentence in a report that a foreign government would look at, for example, Russia would look at and say, the only way they could have known that is if they had somebody in that meeting or somebody that was in that facility that had access to those systems or whatever it is. And with that knowledge, they can narrow down who possibly could have breached that information. And at some point, we could actually lose one of our agents, you know, somebody that we recruited perhaps in the Russian government or Russian military that was providing us invaluable information. That's the essence of counterintelligence. We've had that happen with us for a lot of times. You know, Aldrich Ames, Robert Hansen, they compromised information that they got a lot of agents working for the CIA killed. They were arrested, killed by the Russian Soviet Union. That's also happened the other way around, too, is, you know, that was one of the ways that we found Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen, was that we knew that they had certain intelligence and we were able to narrow that down. So that's one thing. The one that's not quite spectacular in terms of how we perceive it is technical penetrations, you know, technical intelligence, whether it be from satellites or listening to communications or something like that. And when there is something that we've gathered from those means, if they can ever figure that out, they could literally take countermeasures, which could shut down an entire array of ways that we can gather information. And that can have truly profound impact on our ability to understand what other foreign militaries, other foreign countries are doing in this regard. Knowledge is not just power. Knowledge is also security. The more we know, the better decisions we make. So that's what they're doing right now. Is they're looking at all that information, where he was storing it, who could have had access to it, who it could have been shared with. Of course, the big fear, and there probably is a good deal of unknown, is who could have got into those spaces. And since, you know, they were, at least reportedly, they were stored, you know, behind a stage of a banquet room that was a venue that was being used constantly, being stored in other areas where there was open access. You know, they're probably going to have to go with some sort of conclusion that maybe there was a penetration. Now, there have been reports of foreign agents targeting Mar-a-Lago, China, for example. And so that's a big concern that information has been compromised. And some of that we may never actually fully know, because they're not going to release that to the public because it's an internal counterintelligence stuff. That may come up in the court proceedings, but it may come up in a part of the court proceedings that's not available for the public to actually know about.
So what about congressmen, senators, judges on the Supreme Court taking money in lavish gifts from people. Doesn't that compromise their place in our secure system?
I know it's shocking to think of an elected official taking money from somebody.
Stunning.
I mean, when has that ever happened? But
what, a Supreme Court judge? Good grief.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing. I've been watching that too, and there's a famous Roman saying, you know, who watches the watchers?
Right.
And when I look at this stuff with the Supreme Court, it kind of goes back to what we were just talking about with President Trump. You know, in our system, there are certain, you know, it kind of works up the chain of command, if you will, or works up the levels of government. And then you get to the very top and you got, you know, the President of the United States, you know, senior cabinet members, elected officials in Congress. And that kind of is, and of course, Supreme Court justices, the highest court justices in the land. And the system does kind of rely on their integrity,
ethics, morals.
Ethics, morals, whatever you want to say. Well, basically, I was going to say conduct, that they don't do stupid stuff. And so when that's compromised, that's a big issue. And I think they're looking at that. I think, you know, that Justice Roberts has got to look at this they're separate part of government. You know, they're not under the executive branch, it's the judiciary branch. So they're a separate branch of government, co-equal with the other two branches. And it sounds to me like or at least what it looks like to me is they're having to do a much more extensive review of how they do things that we do in the intelligence world and law enforcement and other spheres, you know, more of the enforcement side, which is this extensive ongoing background investigation process, looking at people's, you know, lives, what they're doing, all sorts of stuff to make sure that they're not being compromised. And I think some of this, it sounds to me, and I'm from the outside, I'm obviously not part of any investigative effort or anything like that, but at least from the outside, it looks like they're going to look at the updated, you know, how they do these investigations and stuff to make sure that the justices themselves are not compromising information or skewing their opinion. I think also to allow the court to better decide when certain justices need to recuse themselves from certain cases. I'm like everyone else. I'm a little bit shocked with how much influence was being purchased would be a term. Yeah. You know, when you take people on, you know, when you send somebody on a private jet for a vacation that probably has a monetary value of, you know,
quite a bit.
You know, yeah, I was going to say.
I looked it up.
You
know, I looked up
maybe
some of
the figures, high eight figures, something like that.
Exactly.
If that's not influence buying, I'm not quite sure what is. But
in paying school tuition over $100,000.
Oh,
for
gosh.
Yeah. Oh, and gosh, and I'm not going to declare it on my taxes. Hello. You know, if you go to the Oscars, they give you a swag bag. The actors have to declare the value of that bag on their taxes.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
I can't even go to lunch with a realtor being a mortgage loan officer without splitting the check, or we could get in trouble. I can't buy a realtor lunch.
You know, here's an interesting thing. I come from a, you know, military standpoint. Also, as a, you know, I do a lot of contracting with the government. There are some very strict rules on how that works. And you know, one of the rules is, for example, if you're in uniform and you're going out to say lunch with a contractor, you cannot let them buy you anything. They can't buy you lunch. They can't do anything. That's not a lot. You know, that's certainly not, you know, paying for someone's,
lavish vacation
for their kids to go to a private school or a lavish vacation or something like that. That's a lunch or even a cup of coffee. And, I remember one time I was meeting, I'm in California. I was meeting in Sacramento with somebody, that worked for the state legislature, and we went out. And we were just talking and stuff. And I said, you know, I offered to buy the guy lunch. And he goes, I cannot do that. You know, he says, in the legislature, which was kind of interesting because actually the topic of conversation was, we were actually talking about corruption with the another branch of the government, state government, but which was far, far excess of anything, you know, like a mere lunch. But I was just like, just out of habit, I just like, hey, you want me to pick up lunch? It's like, got my card out. And he's like, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, it just seems strange that, you know, people looking at this wouldn't think, well, you know, our security has been compromised by this Supreme Court judge and probably not just one of them because of all these lavish gifts and the cases they're working on.
It's security, but I also think the decisions themselves, you know, which may have more of a monetary impact on some of these, these very high wealth individuals or companies or the corporations that they represent. I think that actually has more to do with it. And you know, as long as it's there, you know, there's going to be, that's where our system works. That's why we have to watch so closely what public officials do. And I would say we're somewhat remiss in that. And I'd say that actually shows up in some of the body politic opinion that we have that shows up in elections. Is a deep, dare I say, I'm having a great insight here, a deep distrust of government across the board. And that does show up in our, you know, in our voting. It's been a dominant theme in a lot of the elections. And some of that is the making sure that not just that public integrity is being maintained with these officials, but certainly the appearance and the impression amongst the body politic is that there's a very high standard to which we hold them. And so when things like this come out, it's not necessarily the direct impact that it has in a particular court case or a particular government decision or something like that. It's the indirect effect, which has a cumulative effect in the minds of voters and stuff saying, look, we can't trust government. We can't trust government officials, whatever branch. And there is that throw the bums out sort of thing. And that is something.
Like that.
Well,
throw the bums out.
We've seen. Well, that's something we've seen. I mean, dare I discuss U.S. politics in the 1890s? Okay, but there are periods of U.S. history where the White House would change rapidly, you know, who was in charge of Congress would change a lot. And a lot of that was based on public distrust. And a lot of that was based on the amount of change that was going on economically and politically around the world and technologically. You know, it sounds like a complete stretch, but that right now, you know, I'm in Los Angeles. All right. And we have, you know, I'm going to let you know a little secret. We there's films that are produced in Los Angeles. Okay. And television.
Argo.
I've seen it happen. It's shocking. But, you know, that's a big thing out here. If you think the nationwide coverage of the Screen Actors Guild strike is big, you should see the coverage here in Los Angeles. I mean, it is a dominant thing because it's a huge industry.
I used to live there.
Well, then you can, dare I say, picture it.
I identify.
Identify. Well, what's interesting is they're talking about AI and artificial intelligence, and that is actually part of the level of angst across the public is looking at artificial intelligence, what it can and can't do, you know, how well it can mimic individuals. My son just recently graduated from a university out here, and the speaker was talking about the ChatGPT and talking about the ability. You know, the concern they have in the industry, which is part of the strike, was talking about how they could, you know, use this stuff to write term papers and things like that. You know, the strike's concerned about writing scripts. They're concerned about, you know,
being replaced,
images being replaced, and that's also a big concern. That, you know, coming out of the 2016 election with all the you know, the bots in social media that would accentuate certain themes and stuff. That's a huge theme. That's a huge issue that everybody talks about, is this being regulated? Is this being controlled? Are we losing our identity?
I think it's too soon to be really regulated. People are just realizing all the things that AI can do. And that part is kind of scary. And I don't, do they have an agency that says, okay, don't do this, don't do that? And is anybody really following it?
Well, two things. The FBI, which has pretty much jurisdiction on everything, yes, they have some folks following this. They're looking at it very closely. They've been monitoring this for some time. Also, DHS has an outfit called CISA, which is Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. And CISA does a lot of stuff where they look at cybersecurity, they look at AI, and a lot of these things across the board. And they've been putting out some good, I would say, analytical-type products. And I'm just talking about what's publicly released. I'm not talking about internally, whatever they do, but some publicly released documents which talk about this, which speak in broad terms about the potential threat that this poses, the risk that it poses. But it is a reality. It's here. And this is one of the things we have often found, which is somewhat difficult, is some of the things that get pushed, like, we should just shut it down. You know, and that's actually, I've heard that years back. I'm going to date myself on this one, but there was the transition to digital cell phone technology, okay, which seems like eons ago. But one of the problems in law enforcement is that all the intercept technology, this massive investment for intercepting, you know, for listening to phone calls and stuff and investigations, what we call Title III, wiretaps or things like that, that was all based on the old analog system that we had. And so when they went to digital, all of a sudden this huge investment of technology that law enforcement was using across the board, federal, state, local, for law enforcement investigations, all of a sudden had to be replaced to deal with this new digital thing. And so the FBI initially came out and said, we just have to stop digital cell phone technology. And it was kind of like, okay, let's stop this tsunami, all right?
Let's put a wall up.
It's probably not going to work. And so we actually set ourselves back for years because we actually held back.
Weren't proactive with it.
Yeah, so I think that's the same thing we're going to have to
do. Look at what the NRA did in 2015 and 2016. They used it.
Mm-hmm.
And
a lot of that, and in fairness, all right, one can discuss the ethics of it all day long, but I think back in 2015, I don't know if that was illegal per se. Some of those laws have been tightened up since. It was a huge vulnerability. Obviously, the Russians did it. Yeah. And of course, we saw that the Russians also were actively working on penetrating the NRA.
They did.
You know, it's interesting. Well, and they did. And, well, foreign intelligence services, that's what you do. I mean, that's kind of, you
that's
know,
part of the deal.
It's part of the deal. You know, it's like, it's what they'll say you hear in the movies, it's the job.
Yeah.
if you're going to be a spy, your job is to spy on people. That's kind of what you do.
NRA got in trouble because, you know, they're dealing with foreign entities, paying for all this stuff, you know, these people to come here to purposely get involved with our politics. Mm-hmm. So they're on the verge of losing their 501c3 status.
They got involved with a lot of stuff, and it's hurting them. You know, there's a lot of litigation. They're countersuing on some things, but the problem was that certainly the Russians looked at the NRA and saw a lot of vulnerabilities that they could exploit. Also at the time, they'd set up this organization that was kind of a counter, which was sort of a mirror organization in Russia, which dealt with gun rights. That to me is just on the face of it, such a humorous idea that in Russia, you would have an organization that, you know, pushing for individual gun ownership rights. that's so bizarre. But somehow that they set this up, and somebody didn't, there was actually some belief in NRA. It's like, oh, there's a Russian organization that believes the same things we do. Of course they did, because it was kind of an intelligence ploy, and you say, we believe the same things you do. And so they put that out there, and they paid for all these trips of these Russian officials over to go over to Russia. And then when you go over to Russia, there's all sorts of things that they will do to dangle stuff in front of them. Sometimes, dalliances, if you will, where they will do what's called a honey trap. That's not uncommon, that they will try and get them involved in some sort of romantic situation and then use that as compromise material that they can then, coerce them with later to get them to share more things. And what they saw was the NRA was incredibly connected in the halls of Congress and elsewhere. And they kind of saw a way to get in there with some vulnerabilities within the organization and take advantage of that, and to use that as an entree to get, either indirect, get the NRA officials to get in there and hopefully be able to, in their minds, be able to exploit them directly or indirectly to get them to open the doors so they can put their actually trained operatives and get them into offices and places that they otherwise never could have got into. I have to say, that was actually a fairly clever scheme by the Russians when you look at it in terms of how they did that. And it was, very skewed. They just looked across the board, and they said that's where they probably will have greater entry. And historically in politics, it's been, it's gone kind of back and forth. If you go back to the 60s, you wouldn't have found the Soviet Union, really trying to exploit, say, more conservative political organizations. They were exploiting the more leftist side. And so the Soviet Union back then was exploiting the anti-Vietnam War movement as much as they possibly could. And they gained some entrees through that. This is just a different era, different time. They're looking at the political landscape, and they saw where they could exploit that to gather intelligence, to get operations, to conduct covert operations, within the United States. I think we got to be aware of that. I think we also have to be aware, too, that with the war in Ukraine, we're going to see more operations with Russia and probably indirectly with other countries associated with Russia, more intelligence operations, where they're going to rely on what's called non-official cover officers. These are officers that are working covertly overseas some sort of cover. Could be in business, could be non-governmental organizations, could be anything, but they're not in an official diplomatic status. And the reason they're having to do that more is because across the world, the size of the embassy and consulate staffs of the Russians are being dramatically reduced. So they can't use their own personnel in official diplomatic status to do intelligence collection or run intelligence operations in an official cover, because there's just not as many there. And by the way, countries go back and forth doing this every once in a while, where they'll say these diplomats are now persona non grata because they're obviously spies or they're conducting intelligence operations. And this goes back and forth with ourselves and the Russians. And we've done that with the Russians, shutting down various different facilities, reducing their staffs, all sorts of stuff. So they have to look at non-official covers. And so there's a lot of Russian operatives out there in Europe and elsewhere around the world, in the United States, elsewhere, in non-official covers. However, when they, they have to, in those non-official covers, they look for different organizations, different, whether business or non-governmental, that they can affiliate with to maintain that. And I think if you look at the NRA, I'm not saying that anybody working for the NRA was was non-official cover of Russian intelligence, but it was obviously they saw that as a vulnerable organization that they could exploit in a lot of different ways. And they did use operatives, obviously, that were in non-official cover to do that. And, of course, that became part of that big, I forget which year that was, that we had the big trade of all these ostensibly, Americans, kind of like the TV show. They were deep cover Russian operatives who had lived here for years.
Oh, I remember that. You know, yeah.
Yeah, and then there was a big spy trade, and I'm trying to remember her name, that she's now like a TV personality.
Yeah, a redhead.
Over in Russia. Yeah, well, see, it might as well go on television because, her spy days are over. I'm trying to remember. There was an old Dean Martin, Matt Helm movie. I remember a famous line where they looked at Dean Martin. Someone says, "You're the world's most famous secret agent," and that's kind of her situation. She's kind of the world's most famous secret agent, which means that one part of her career pattern is probably over. So,
yeah, no doubt.
Anyway.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few to talk about the border. Hi, this is Sherry asking you to save the dates. On August 5th, Law Matters is hosting a free double feature movie presentation on topics that affect all youth in today's digital world. Bullying, sextortion, and how your children are being sex trafficked right out of your home. Every teacher, parent, and age-appropriate student should attend. After each movie, there will be a Q&A panel made up of law enforcement and prosecutors to answer your questions. Tune in to Law Matters every Saturday morning at 8, and updates will be posted on the lawmatters1030.org website as details develop.
This is Deputy Chuk with Pima County Search and Rescue, reminding you that infants and toddlers do not experience heat as adults do. Consider this when bringing your young ones on a hike in temperatures of over 80 degrees. You do not want to risk that child having heat stroke or being arrested for child endangerment. If you're thinking of a trek through nature, plan ahead, look ahead, and use your head. Your future depends on it. Save your phone's battery life so when you get lost, we may contact you. Wearing bright colors that can be seen from a distance helps the effort.
Law Matters Live Show works hard at keeping you informed on current issues from all law enforcement agencies, including any rule changes in both the tax and mortgage industries. I host the show as a volunteer. My real job is working for a mortgage broker with over 20 resources in residential, commercial, jumbo, as well as a reverse company whose new rule is offering tax-free money to those 55 and older, qualifying for up to $4 million. If you want to learn more, call me after the show at 520-310-9900. Hi, this is Sherry asking you to save the dates. On August 5th, Law Matters is hosting a free double feature movie presentation on topics that affect all youth in today's digital world. Bullying, sextortion, and how your children are being sex trafficked right out of your home. Every teacher, parent, and age-appropriate student should attend. After each movie, there will be a Q&A panel made up of law enforcement and prosecutors to answer your questions. Tune in to Law Matters every Saturday morning at 8, and updates will be posted on the lawmatters1030.org website as details develop. Okay, thanks for staying with us. We have Hal Kemper on. He's the CEO of GRIP, and we've been talking about national security issues, actually some of the things that are happening right here. I want to talk about the border. I heard that they took the balloons down and they're not going to replace them. Have you heard that?
Well, they are. Yes, I have. And there's been a program of reducing the number of aerostats. That's the fancy term for the balloons, the blimps, if you will. That program has been around for a long time. Aerostats really came into vogue in the 80s. And if you really want to go back, it goes back to literally, I think, World War I, they were using aerostats as a way to intercept aircraft, and World War II to intercept aircraft flying over Britain and elsewhere. It's, the thing is, you can raise them up, they're lighter than air, and they stay there. And you don't have to use any energy, if you will, any fuel or whatever, to keep them up because, well, it's just basic lighter than air physics maintains them at an altitude. And with that, you can put things on them, cameras, infrared sensors, all sorts of different sensor systems that you can use to maintain a certain visibility over an area. Things that allow you to see in periods of darkness or when, it could be fog or whatever. There's a lot of different things you can do with an aerostat. Of course, the vulnerability of an aerostat generally is if the weather's bad, if the winds are honking, if you will, usually it's a bad time to fly an aerostat. It's a bad time to fly, period. But aerostats, particularly because they're so big, they have this big cross-section for the wind. So it becomes very difficult to control them. And so they like to take them down. Now, with that said, it's been around for a very long time. You know, they're putting them up in the 80s. You know, I've done training down at Fort Huachuca, you know, down around Sierra Vista on the border, you know, big aerostat down there. I've been overseas where we were, you know, in Iraq where we had a smaller aerostat type program that was being used. And it's been around for a while. I know it was used down in Central America for some stuff back in the 80s, and it's okay. One of the problems with some aerostats, depending on how high you fly them, is they tend to get shot a lot, believe it or not. Who would think that would happen?
And, go figure.
So there's a constant maintenance issue with those things. There's a constant maintenance issue with those things across the board. The ones we have are less advanced, if you will, than some of the more modern models. And the other thing, too, is that the technology is so much smaller. You know, what they originally would put on these things, they really needed something big because they were so heavy. Now they can put that technology in a fairly compact arrangement, and hence the proliferation of drones. When we put the aerostats up, we didn't have all these drones like Predators and Reapers and even Global Hawks and all these other amazing drone systems, or these smaller drones. You know, ones that you can literally launch by throwing it off your arm like a dragonfly or something like that. We didn't have these amazing drone systems that we have now. So with that said, drones for overhead surveillance, regardless of whatever sensor package is on them, have in many ways picked up a lot of the intelligence collection load that we would do with aerostats. And they do it more covertly. You know, when there's an aerostat up in the sky, everybody sees the aerostat. They know it's there. And when there's a little drone up there flying at 10,000 feet or something, they may or may not notice it's there. And in most cases, the drone can covertly monitor, surveil, if you will, whatever's going on the ground without the bad guys knowing it's there. So there's a certain advantage with that. Of course, one thing you can do with an aerostat is you can also use them for deception operations. This goes way, way back. But, you know, one of the things we always realized was that, and I should mention, in the 90s, I was very much involved with the war on drugs with a joint task force. For years, it was the joint task force that was responsible for all military operations along the southwest border. And so there was a lot of things that could be done. And, of course, if you put the aerostat up, and the drug traffickers or the smugglers say, oh, the aerostat's up, they might move to a different location. Well, you know, after a while you go, that's interesting. And so you might put the aerostat up and you might do a little bit of analysis and figure out, okay, they're probably going to come over here where they think we can't see them. And so they would. And that was that. You know, you'd have some people there to greet them, to make sure they felt welcome when they came into the United States, and then to, you know, provide them all those things that the United States government can't provide people who are trying to smuggle things into the United States. So that's an advantage with using an aerostat. That's an advantage with doing anything that's overt. An overt collection, I'll just say aerostats are not a covert collection asset. They're pretty overt. But that's one of the things you can use those for. So not the only overt collection asset we use, but there is a little bit of tactical or operational deception that we can use with these things as well.
When I went down to the border, Sheriff Mark Daniels and his deputies have a huge area of the border, and they took me down to an area, and one of the deputies showed me, he just pointed up to the top of this hill, not really a mountain, but a hill. And he said, you see those people on top of that hill? They're on our side of the border, and they're watching to make sure that, you know, if their people are coming across and we're over here, they're telling their people to go over there so they don't be, they can't be intercepted. You know, they kind of monitor what's going on. And I'm like, well, get them off the hill. You know, he said, you know, you're sitting here with company or a department issue weapon. They're up there with AR-15s.
You know, that's a big challenge. And all the cartels, you know, that's one of the things with the cartels is that they have a lot of money. And a phenomenal amount of money. Now, if you're in Mexico and you get into this whole discussion, they say, well, yeah, we wouldn't have a lot of money if it wasn't for all these, you know, United States citizens that are buying the dope that we are smuggling.
Right.
And so there's always that discussion that goes back and forth. But with that, they have a lot of money, and they have been able to, you know, way back when, they can buy a lot of talent. I know there were concerns that at the end of the Cold War, they were buying talent from, you know, the Warsaw Pact and particularly the Soviet Union. They were, you know, there was a lot of, you know, hardworking commies that were out of a job, so to speak. So they had skills and they were useful to the cartels with those tactical skills that they had accrued over the years. And then, of course, there's other places, you know, when we had the big fight against, you know, the communists down in El Salvador. Well, the civil war is over. You got a lot of people down there with a lot of tactical skills that suddenly were out of a job. So they're looking for places to work. So
now they're sitting on a mountain in Cochise County.
Well, it's not quite that direct, but yeah, I mean, things have changed over time. And, you know, if you go to, you know, into like Los Zetas, which was basically came from an airborne battalion that basically was hired by the Gulf cartel as an enforcer site, but they had a lot of tactical skills. And with that, we've seen a proliferation of those military or paramilitary skill sets throughout the cartels in terms of what they do. Now, I have to tell you, if I was putting a signals intelligence hat on and I see somebody on our side of the border as a lookout, you know, observation post or something like that, and he's on our side of the border, I would come up with some creative ways to, I would consider that reasonable suspicion, maybe probable cause, to figure out some way to intercept whatever communications they're using back and forth. And with that, I might be able to put together that guy is talking to drug traffickers or human traffickers on the other side of the border, which could potentially put together a case to prosecute that person that's sitting up on top of the hill. Now, the issue is, how do you get up there and enforce that? That's a big challenge. You know, getting up there and enforcing it's a big challenge. You know, that's a manpower intensive sort of thing.
Should the county sheriff have drones?
I think, honestly,
all departments.
I guess that's kind of where I am. All departments. Different drones, you know, for different jurisdictions depends on what you need. You know, the county sheriff doesn't need global hawk flying at 80,000 feet, you know, looking at half the southern border. But there are certain drones. It's cost effective. It's less manpower intensive. Putting a manned aircraft up usually costs a lot of money, and there's limitations. You know, years back, for example, one of the great tools, and I actually flew with these guys, was with the Civil Air Patrol, and they had a thing under the counter drug funding that went to Civil Air Patrol. So I actually caught hops with these guys to go to various interagency civil military multi jurisdictional meetings, if you will. There's enough specialized terms in that area, but they would fly, and I talked to, you know, you can have a lot of time with a pilot. A lot of times you're going to a Cessna or something and you just have time to talk, and they were flying you know, racetracks up around the border because they were so cost effective. A Cessna is, you know, that's, you know, they really didn't have to pay the pilot. The pilots were glad for the flight time, so they pay for the fuel for the plane to fly, and they would fly around the border looking for things. That's good, but you know, your sensor system is the, as we say, the Mark 1A1 eyeballs of the pilot, who's also flying the plane at the same time. So they're somewhat of a limited collector in that regard. Now, some of these planes with light planes are okay, and they use those very extensively for aerial surveillance. But actually, drones, at this point of the game, with the technology where it's at, the affordability, the ability to use drones, I'm a big believer in that. And among other things, I would say that a part of the kit bag that officers should have with them are tactical drones that they can use for close-in surveillance for anything. That could be, you know, if you have someone barricading a house, you could launch a drone and do basically a reconnaissance around the house.
Yeah, I think some agencies have that. Yeah, some agencies already have that. But I'm thinking, well, you know, if you've got people coming over the border and you had a drone following them, like you and I were talking about yesterday, you could follow them across the country to find out where they go and what are they doing.
Well, that was what we were talking about. That was I did a lot of work with customs, U.S. customs, and there is what we call the customs domain. All right. And when someone comes into the country, and this is usually more focused on products, but working with immigration, it also works on people as well, just as easily. But when they come into the country, if you can pick them up coming into the country, you can follow them wherever they go. So, for example, if a load comes up, you know, a container comes up to the border and crosses the border, under U.S. law, they could watch that container until it gets delivered in Topeka, Kansas. And in a warehouse, they could literally go into the warehouse and say, okay, we want to search that container. And, of course, the warehouse will say, where's your warrant or everything? It's like, no, you brought in something that came across the customs domain. You have to open that up. Now, anything else they see is in plain view. But that's under U.S. law that can happen. And they can also track these individuals. And that, you know, in all fairness, you know, sometimes you don't necessarily want to intercept them at the border. You'd like to see where they end up.
Right.
You know, you may want to, you know, if it's narcotics, you may want to follow that load until it gets up into Los Angeles to wherever it's going to go. And then once it goes in there, once it goes someplace, then you do the enforcement action, and you're going to, you know, gather a lot more investigative leads, if you will, from that, along with arresting a lot of people and various other things. And of course, from a federal standpoint, if the federal, you know, the U.S. border is a federal jurisdiction, from a federal standpoint, if they do that, they can also share some of the accolades with local law enforcement to get involved in. And it's multi-jurisdictional. You know, credit sharing is a pretty good idea. So that's there's a lot of advantages of doing it that way, as opposed to just taking the load down at the border.
So we need to get drones for our law enforcement agencies.
I firmly believe that. In fact, I think I'm not saying that every patrol car should have a drone. I think that's very possible. If you look at these little tiny handheld drones that we've been using overseas in the military, those are available. Those provide, it's not a huge drone, but you can literally launch it out of the palm of your hand, and you can imagine the number of tactical situations or operational situations where just being able to put up a little drone that could fly around the corner or around a building or around cars or something like that would provide tremendous information for the officers involved in a situation. But also for other situations like along the border, larger drones that may have more persistent loiter time that can fly over. You know, I've done a lot of stuff in the field. I've done a lot of stuff in very tactical situations. And frankly, the ability to look on what's on the other side of the hill or around the, you know, what's on the other side of those bushes or whatever is an incredible advantage when you're doing something out there. You know, it's a, you know, beyond catching bad guys, it's also avoiding walking into an ambush or something like that. So there's a lot of value in having these drones.
Yeah, keep our law enforcement guys safe.
That's the idea. Yeah. Yes, very much so.
So. I want to get on to Russia because I heard that, you know, they've got some missing generals and they're swearing no windows were open. So they're not sure what happened. So
yeah, there's an Amber Alert out for them right now. They're trying to find these missing generals.
So what's going on
not
over
sure
there?
What happened? You know, there was, more than missing generals. Very interesting. In Russia, there was a Navy captain who was commander of a submarine that last year had fired a number of missiles into a city in Ukraine that killed about 27 civilians. Well, they were able to figure out which submarine fired those missiles. And he was out for a run this last week, and they think they were tracking him on kind of a Russian version of a Fitbit type thing, you know, where you do
right.
stuff. And they intercepted him and killed him. No one's quite sure who did it. They think could have been Ukrainian special operations, could have been Ukrainian intelligence, could have been anti-Putin Russians. It's not quite clear. But it was rather amazing. But this guy was back home. He's a naval officer. He's just out for like a noontime run. And they were able to intercept him and take him down. And that's got to cause some angst. You may have seen where the commander, Major General Popov, who is the commander of the 58th Combined Arms Army. That's a large organization. That's the equivalent of one of our corps, if you will. It's above a division. Very large organization. Very critical organization. In terms of the Ukrainian military operations for the Russians, he was relieved, and there's an audio tape that's out there where he's talking about why he was fired, and the reason he was fired, which sounds a lot like Prigozhin, you know, the head of the Wagner group that did the rebellion
right.
Some weeks back, was he was criticizing the Ministry of Defense for not providing the support that his forces needed, you know, not providing the ammunition, not providing what's called counter battery fire, which means when they're taking artillery fire or rocket fire from the Ukrainians, that he didn't have the means to return fire to take out those artillery or rocket units, which is great for the Ukrainians. I mean, that's you know, if they lack that capability, the Ukrainians are, you know, if you're out there, pretty happy if you're a Ukrainian artilleryman. But he was complaining about that. He was basically complaining across the board, apparently been very vocal about it. They relieved him. They fired him and replaced him. And that audio tape is getting shared. It was on Telegram, from what I understand, which is kind of their big social media thing. And the fact that you have that falling on the hill, that kind of criticism, not just the rebellion of the Wagner group trying to go up to Moscow, but it was right before that action where he went down to Rostov and basically walked into the southern region military headquarters and had to sit down chat with the commander and the senior intelligence officer there that was all over the news. And then his force went before that. Prigozhin was extremely vocal and basically said that the entire war was based on a lie. And that's similar to what it is. And Popov was kind of saying the same thing. And so he was fired. And these things kind of seep into the Russian consciousness, particularly with the intelligentsia the more, you know, urban elites, if you will, those that have the means to gather that information more effectively than, say, someone who's in rural Russia, you know, somewhere in the middle of the country, Moscovites, St. Petersburg residents, others that can get into this information flow. They're seeing this and they're reading this stuff and they're really having some deep questions raise their minds. And then there was a lieutenant general who was killed. He'd been shot earlier in the war, survived, and he was basically at a headquarters building that was, I guess, pretty well known. And the assessment was that the Ukrainians, the Russians, kind of knew that the Ukrainians knew about this headquarters building. And, you know, a little kudos to Ukrainian intelligence. When he was in there at a particular time, they managed to target that building and killed him. And he's the highest-ranking Russian general that they've taken out. And then, of course, up in Moscow, you know, you have a number of generals who disappeared right about the time of the rebellion, to include a four-star general who at one time was head of all military operations in Ukraine. And so when you look at this, you know, there's been a kind of a purge, if you will, of general officers, which kind of raises a lot of questions of how much hate and discontent, how much frustration is there in the Russian military across the board. And even though he can keep purging them, it's not the same. And Putin loves Stalin, and Stalin was pretty famous for purges. Of course, Stalin almost lost the Soviet Union at the beginning of World War II because he purged most of his generals and senior military officers because he thought they might be a political threat to him. So he took them off.
Them.
Of course, then ironically, some of the great heroes of the Soviet Union in World War II were officers that they had to pull out of the Stalags and then put back in service. And it's like, okay, you were an enemy. Okay, you're now our friend, and we're going to put you back in charge of a bunch of troops. Because he realized that he needed military officers who actually knew what they were doing. And
where do you find them? You can't go to Craigslist or, you know, the iHire place to get those. We only have a couple of minutes left. I want to talk about China antagonizing our military and doing what they're doing. What's up with that?
Well, they're, you know, part of this, I don't want to doll this up, but part of the Barbie controversy ties to this is China has this thing that they've maintained forever called the nine dash line claim across the South China Sea. And it really is basically they're claiming the South China Sea is Chinese waters. Now, obviously, the waters that they're claiming belong to other countries like the Philippines, Malaysia, Vietnam. None of those countries are too thrilled about that. And that's why you see Vietnam ban the Barbie movie. Philippines is looking at banning the Barbie movie, was because somewhere in whoever, you know, the producers of the Barbie movie, they decided to show a map of China's claim of the nine dash line. I don't know how that was a critical plot instrument in whatever that movie is about. But anyway, they had that in there, which really irritated them. The problem with this is things like the Chinese Strait. 60% of the container traffic, seagoing container traffic around the world, goes through the Straits of Taiwan. It's a phenomenal amount that goes through that area. There's a phenomenal amount of traffic that goes through the South China Sea. China feels that that is their lake. And obviously the international courts, the United Nations, doesn't agree with these claims. So they go out there and they do these provocative moves. The most recent one is that Canadian ship and one of our ships are doing a joint patrol, what we call freedom of navigation, going through the Taiwan Straits. And one of their, I think it was a destroyer, cut right in front of our ship. And there's enough that they could feel the wake. It was enough to cause a navigation change on the U.S. ship that it had to avoid a collision. And it was very unsafe. Was what they did. There's a thing called coal regs, which deal with proper conduct of vessels at sea around the world that everybody abides by. This was a flagrant violation of the coal regs in terms of what they did. So that's a very provocative move. Of course, you may have also seen yesterday that, or last 3 days, that the China's been flying aircraft across the median line in the Taiwan Straits in order to test Taiwanese air defense. A lot of provocative moves in the air, on the sea, and also provocative moves further south. In Philippine waters, they have been constantly doing this, but they've been doing this recently, where they will surge what they call Chinese Coast Guard vessels. By the way, a lot of these Chinese Coast Guard vessels used to be painted gray, and they were part of the Chinese Navy. And so years back, as a deception or strategic communications thing,
30 seconds,
they pulled them back in a port, painted them white, and said they're Coast Guard, because everybody likes the Coast Guard. Yeah, and then they put them right back at sea, doing the same thing they were doing as part of the Chinese Navy. But that's another issue. So,
do you think they're trying to provoke war?
I think they would, if there's a war, they would prefer that somebody else shoots first so they can call it a defensive war. I think that's a kind of really almost a moot point once you go to war, but they would like to do that. But the other thing is they're trying to, what they can't do through legal means in the international courts and certainly working with the United Nations, they're trying to do through brute force de facto means, which is we're just going to put our ships down there and force everybody out of those waters by some of these very aggressive moves that we're making in the air and the water to try and make them stop.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show and bringing us up to date on everything. And I want you to have a good weekend. I want everybody out there to shop local and stay safe. Thanks, Hal.
Thanks, Sherry.